Good evening and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. For those of you who are celebrating Easter, I say happy Easter to you. And but today we'll be discussing three topics. So first of all, we'll discuss the Binance executives who are being charged by the Nigerian government. One of them apparently escaped, so we'll discuss the circumstances surrounding his escape. I would also discuss the nature of the charges that have been filed against them. Secondly, we'll discuss the new tariffs that have been introduced by the Minister for Power, Mr. Bayo Adelabu. Apparently, he's now created three bands, band A, band B, band C, I think, for determining how much people pay for electricity. So we'll discuss the circumstances and the merits of the policy. And thirdly, we'll discuss Kaduna State Government. The governor, Uba Sani, claims he's unable to deliver or perform because he inherited a mountain of debt from his successor. So, Phoenix, Binance. On the one hand, we understand one of the executives has escaped and the other is still in detention but standing trial. So how did he escape, Phoenix? I thought he was under high security. So how did this Binance executive escape, Phoenix?
Hi, Michael. Hello, listeners. And thanks, Limona and Chris, for joining us this week. Well, we can only go by what we were told, which is as ludicrous as it sounds. We're told that the gentleman was escorted by the security people who were watching over him and his colleague, and he was escorted to go do the Muslim prayer, and he disappeared from there. He disappeared from there, and they also speculate, I don't know if they confirmed it, but they also say that he then left the country, not through the bush or, you know, through one of our porous borders. He actually boarded a plane and immediately stand airline and left Nigeria. Now, bear in mind that his passport was supposedly in the custody of Nigeria's security forces. And so we don't know how, what travel document he traveled on, and why any airline, knowing that he, at least that's typically what happens in security circles, when you have somebody who's a person of interest in your custody, you make sure that all your borders, all airlines are notified so that that kind of person cannot leave. And so it's strange to me that this person was actually able to get to one of our airports, presumably the same Abuja airport, because it was held in Abuja, and board a plane and leave the country. So that's what we've heard. What we've also heard is they've alerted Interpol to find him in order for them to bring him back to Nigeria. That hasn't happened so far. So that's what I know, of course, what I've heard of how he escaped. Hilarious.
Thank you, Phoenix. So the individual who apparently escaped, his name is Nadim Anjarwala. He's apparently a British Kenyan, and he was the regional manager for Africa. And there's been speculation that, are we sure the British or the Kenyan authorities didn't do a deal with the Nigerian government? Do you think there's truth to that?
Well, a Binance executive, what would be the benefit to them for that? I think, because the other gentleman, Gambarian, I think, is a U.S. citizen. I think to the kind of charges they're supposedly facing, and don't forget, Binance is not exactly Binance has been in too many controversies and in too many issues for things ranging from money laundering to tax evasion that they've even paid fines in the US, if I recall correctly. So it's not like any government, in my mind, would be jumping up and down to protect any Binance executive, because if it is proven that, yes, they have been doing things wrongly, they would not want that backlash on them. So they will have what the pressure they will have put on, to my mind, is to make sure that it follows due process. Charge them to court, let's see what happens, and blah, blah, blah. But to get into a situation where they will try to effect the release sounds strange to me. If you ask me, what I would think is somebody must have cut a deal with some of these Nigerian folks, as we know how badly behaved our people can be, to enable this guy to leave. Maybe some crypto exchange hands.
Thank you, Phoenix. So let's ask Ilemona. Ilemona, you're a member of the People's Democratic Party. Sorry, I don't think I introduced. Did I introduce you guys at the start of this podcast?
No, you didn't. We just went along.
Sorry, I think my memory is I'm getting old. When you get to my age, you start forgetting. So apologies, listeners. We've actually got two guests here. So our first guest is Ilemona. Ilemona is a member of the People's Democratic Party. And our second guest is Chris. Chris is a corporate strategy professional. So I sincerely apologize for not introducing you. That's old age. I blame Joe Biden. I inherited Joe Biden's old age. But anyway, as we're saying, so Ilemona, you're in the PDP. Do you believe that these men truly escaped, or do you share Phoenix's suspicions that perhaps some kind of deal was cut to maybe the guy paid, crypto payment to escape? Is that what you think happened? What do you think, Ilemona?
What I do know, forget what I think for a second, what I do know is that was a failure of security right there. That is a high profile detainee detained in the custody of the National Security Advisor, no less. The National Security Advisor. If the National Security Advisor cannot secure in his custody a high-profile detainee, what does it say about his capacity to secure the ordinary Nigerian on the street? It's a failure of security straight away. Whether it is that they escaped, whether it is that they were able to make a payment to someone to facilitate their escape, it doesn't matter. Security failed and failed woefully. On the one hand, it gets worse when you consider that they were detained in Abuja, the nation's capital. If what we have heard is anything to go by, he flew out of the nation's capital from the nation's capital airport. So a drive from to the airport from wherever you are in Abuja probably takes you about 40 minutes. So he had 40 minutes to get to the airport. He had what, another maybe 15, 20 minutes? Check now. Note, he left on a commercial airline. He didn't leave on a private jet, at least from what we're told. He had time to check onto that, wait, board, wait before they took off, and the nation's security architecture didn't pick that up. My goodness. It says if there's anything that speaks to the incompetence of the National Security Advisor, Alhaji Ibadu, and his inability to perform his role, that failure is monumental. And it simply just explains why criminals waltz in and out of the city, kidnap people at will, kidnap people across the country. And it just, that thing, massive failure. I mean, on the one hand, we can talk about the unsuitability of the charges before that these men are facing before we're supposed to face, or that one of them is facing before our courts. All this talk about currency distortions and all of that, we know that it is a smokescreen that the government has built and put in place to mask its inefficiency, to mask its incompetence. So all that is there. We can take that. I mean, that is taken for granted. It's a saga. It's an episode that shouldn't be happening in the first place. But given that it has happened, or that it is happening, how is security failing that badly? How did our security fail that bad? Let me tell you something. I don't know what the equivalent role is. Well, I'll use the United States. If the United States of America has in the custody an announcement made by the Office of the National Security Advisor that someone is detained in their custody and is being detained in one of the guest houses belonging or under the supervision and control of the National Security Advisor, and that person was able to escape and flee the country, the NSA in the US would have been fired by now. It's a testament to the anyhowness of the Nigerian nation, this country that we call our own, that the NSA is still in office. Shameful.
No, thank you, Ilemona. But I need to bring in Chris at this point, because there's two issues I need to get further clarity on. So first of all, Chris, they said, according to news reports, I'm looking at Reuters said they were detained on the 26th of February. And the first time they're being charged is going to be on the 8th, which is tomorrow, the 8th and the 19th of April. So they've been held since the 26th of February. Is this legal to hold people for that long and only charge them almost 2 months after? Chris?
Well, you don't need me to tell you what the Nigerian judiciary system looks like. We've got a learned lawyer on the podcast this week who can shed as much light as we need on how terrible and how inefficient and just completely lopsided the justice system can be in Nigeria to the ordinary person. One of the things, just to build on what Ilemona said about the circumstances leading to their arrest or detention or however you want to describe it, is just the fact that it looks like, and I think there was someone from the US Commerce Department who described it as akin to a state-sponsored kidnapping. It appears that these two gentlemen are in a hostage situation, which is quite apt when you think about the level of kidnapping and general banditry that goes on in the country. This looks, from outside looking in, like a state-sponsored kidnapping. The two gentlemen being held are not competent to face the charges that are being leveled against them. The two gentlemen do not have any kind of decision-making responsibilities for Binance in terms of setting the direction of what the company can or cannot do. These are just two middle managers who were invited to come and help the government on their quest to arrest the slide of the Naira and alleged unknown transactions and anonymous transactions that were impacting the currency. So this would be, pick any company that has a footprint in Nigeria, sending two middle managers, a regional manager, a regional director in to meet with a regulator or members of the government. And suddenly, they're in detention for close to two months with no prospect of a speedy trial. There's no legal entity for Binance in Nigeria. So the whole thing, I'm afraid to say, looks, from outside looking in, I can't speak to the intricate legalities of it, but from outside looking in, it looks a lot like a shakedown. And it reminds me a lot of the previous government and their entanglements with Twitter. And I wonder if this is just a ploy and a bit of a hostage situation to get some money out of those guys. Now, having said that, Binance is not a neutral actor. They're not saints, because if you look at multiple jurisdictions around the world, They've been fined billions, hundreds of millions in cases around some of their alleged failures in KYC, in transaction monitoring, and in data privacy. So there may well be legitimate cases to answer for Binance in how the platform operates in Nigeria. But linking this to the currency slide, the way they've been detained, I know through the grapevine, I know people who know this, who work with this guy who is alleged to have escaped, the treatment that they had while they were in detention left a lot to be desired. Lack of contact with their families, lack of contact initially with the consular support from the US, Kenya, and from the UK. Medication not being offered to them in a timely manner, leading to more complications. So the whole thing stinks. It hasn't gone through due process, I don't think. And for me, it all looks a lot like a shakedown. And this kind of postponement of the court case is just another manifestation of how lopsided the justice system can be in Nigeria.
Thank you, Chris.
I'd like to just jump in there, yeah?
Oh yes, please go ahead, Lebanon.
It is exactly what it is. It's a shakedown. It is a mask, first and foremost, for incompetence. When they say, oh, Binance is distorted, the exchange rates and everything, that is a load of tosh. In the first place, everybody who is sensible and who wants to be honest and not, high on some government-fueled agenda knows that Nigeria simply, our exchange rate is simply all over the place because the people who manage the economy, who did so for 8 years before this administration came into power and who continue to do so, simply aren't putting in place the fundamentals that either guarantee productivity, that guarantees a constant supply of forex to ensure that, simple demand and supply, is that exchange rates are lower, or any policies or who implement any policies that guarantee stability. These are the two key issues. For example, right now, customs gives you one exchange rate, right? In the IFM, the government is selling to BDCs at a different exchange rate. There is yet a third exchange rate on another agency that I'm trying to remember. So it's customs, there's a third one. If you're an MPA, if you're importing, if you're paying for goods and services at the port. So by itself, the government is distorting by the running of multiple exchange rate windows. The government is in it by itself creating problems. The government is saying to people, no, do not trade in Forex. No, do not have Forex. No, you people who are keeping your savings in dollars are distorting the value of the naira and then therefore causing ripple effects on the economy. No, okay, but the government is in itself charging for very serious, very critical parts of the economy, very critical services. Government is charging us in dollars, and they're not doing it at a flat rate or at a stable rate, but is by itself creating the incentive that people can buy here and sell there. It's a smokescreen. It's a shakedown in the first place. But then when you go from there, one of the major failures of government, of the Nigerian government, and this is not necessarily an APC problem, but APC is the government in power now who ought to be fixing that problem. It is this thing that we do where, you arrest people, you detain them, then say you are conducting investigations. It has never made sense. It will never make sense. It leads to one of the most shocking statistics anywhere in the world. 70% of the people detained in correctional facilities across the Federal Republic of Nigeria. This is minus in police stations and all those, their SARS facilities. I'm talking about prisons. 70% of the people in Nigerian prisons are awaiting trial. Of that number, a significant percentage are awaiting trial on account of government saying they are conducting or they are waiting to complete their investigations. It makes no sense.
Thank you, Ilemona. Let me just bring in Phoenix to provide his final thoughts on this topic. So, Phoenix, how is this going to work practically? Because you've heard what Ilemona and Chris have said. So, these two individuals, Mr. Gambarayan and Anjarwalla, they are not members of the board of directors, neither are they officers of the company. But yet, they are being held responsible by the Nigerian state for the corporate decisions of Binance. And interestingly, Binance itself has not been charged by the Nigerian government. So it seems to be the equivalent of grabbing two junior employees of a company, or maybe a bank, for example, Goldman Sachs, and accusing them of being the conduits for money laundering by the bank. So how is this supposed to work? Do you think these charges can survive in the Nigerian courts, Phoenix? Or would you think they'll be thrown out based on the fact that you've not charged Binance and these two individuals were not directors or officers?
Well, if we have a proper judicial system, the charges should be thrown out. I mean, number one, the guy, it would even have been easier if they had been able to hold on to Anjarwalla himself, because at least he's in a while he is a mid-level employee, he is the regional manager, so he's the face of Binance in Africa. So at least if you held him, you could say that yes, Binance Nigeria being operating under Binance Africa, blah blah blah. You know, you can the guy they have with them right now. He's a compliance officer. He's not in any way, can they make a case that he is going to stand, that he can be the one that then takes the hit on behalf of Binance? Because you're right, like you rightly said, Binance itself has not been charged. Now, that could be as a result of the fact that there is no Binance entity. But if you have a case against Binance and you can prove it, then you go to where Binance has an entity, whether it be, I don't know whether their Africa headquarters is in Kenya or South Africa, either you go there and go and make a case, or you go to the US itself or whatever you want to do. But the guy they are holding now and the case they are building against him in his personal capacity simply makes no sense. No court should entertain what they are bringing forward. So let's hope that they don't continue to debase the judicial system and find a judge who is willing to write something stupid to continue this charade that they have. But it's very clear that the number one jumped the gun on whatever case they were trying to prove that Binance had distorted the Nigerian, you know, FX market and led to a run on the Naira. They did not build the right case as usual, which is what we've come to see not only of EFCC, but now we have seen that even the NSA architecture shows gross incompetence. I have always said that I did not expect much of Nuhu Ribadu in that role, and he has proven me right, at least in this instance. So, I mean, it's now a case of how they walk back from this clown show that they've started and find, you know, if there's truly a case against Binance, find a way that they can, you know, make their case in a way that, you know, truly holds the company accountable and not just this gentleman that they are holding, which only makes Nigeria look bad. It is kidnap. It's that simple. It is that simple. You cannot hold an employee, especially somebody in the role that he has. He doesn't have an executive position. He is not a partner. He is not and he's not a majority owner. He's not an executive that, makes decisions. What are you doing? It makes no sense. So I'm hoping that the judiciary, does its job in the right way and calls this the nonsense that it is and ensures that they release the man and, we can move on from this shameful episode.
Sorry, Michael, just to say one thing. I
Okay.
always like to point out the wider implications of some of these seemingly throwaway things. And I know that a lot of people will defend the fact that Binance is a bad actor in Nigerian economy, etc. But just imagine the kinds of conversations that are going on in companies that are headquartered outside of Nigeria who have operations in Nigeria. As a middle manager, as a person doing a job within an organization of any kind of size, international organization, that ends up in some sort of standoff or dispute or needs clarification needs to clarify anything with the Nigerian government or any Nigerian regulator. If you're based in London, if you're based in DC or wherever you're based, would you get on a plane to go and answer an invitation if you've been invited by a Nigerian regulator, knowing that as a middle manager you could be held fiduciarily liable for what your company has done, over which you have no direct control? So it's another thing that's, it might look quite small and quite specific to the Binance case. And yes, Binance may end up, being found to have done something wrong, overall, certainly not with the exchange rate, as I said earlier. But it's just that kind of chill factor. It's just that ripple effect that it has. You just have something written down in a document somewhere saying, right, so Nigeria, if you ask me to go, I'm not going. And it just sends that wider chill around, inward investment and kind of people we need to come support the growth of the economy.
And that's such a great point. I mean, it doesn't even need to get to the point where there is a disagreement or there's an issue that they're asking to come and answer for. It starts with just being able to attract investment. Whenever you ask people to come and invest in your country, they will also send people because there might also be a lack of technical expertise or, you want some leadership to come here. Please explain to me how people will be open to relocating Nigeria to come and take up jobs here, knowing fully well that if something goes wrong, they can be detained. Exactly the point that Chris is making. I'm even saying, I mean, being able to attract investment, which would come with some talent that needs to come across. It's ridiculous. I mean that you have somebody who's going to the New York Stock Exchange and drumming up requests for investment and doesn't realize that some of these things that you do that go against common decency and rule of law have an impact.
Well, thank you, Phoenix. I think you've all made important points, and hopefully the Nigerian policymakers are listening. And I also wish that I hope that the judiciary fulfills its role in as objectively as possible. But on to our next topic because of time. I want you to hold on, Phoenix, because I wanted you to talk us through this issue. So the Minister for Power, Mr. Bayo Adelabu, announced some new tariffs for electricity consumption. Could you explain to us in layman's terms what exactly has been announced? Because I've been seeing things about band A, band B, band C, and I'm trying to work out what do all these things mean, Phoenix? Can you explain to us in layman's terms?
Well, Michael, I can only state what they've explained. I mean, the explanation to me is some of it just befuddles me. But let's try. So what they've announced is that there has been a restructuring of tariffs. Now, bear in mind, a lot of people who listen to Nigeria Politics the Weekly will have heard me talk about, subsidies, consumption subsidies being a killer and something that I totally disagree with. So anything to make sure that we're going off consumption subsidies and subsidizing production, subsidizing, areas that would, trigger a return and a multiplier effect, is I'm all for that. So yes, we know that the multi-year tariff plan has not been reviewed in a long time due to our friend Buhari's statist approach and populist agenda that was running Nigeria aground and destroyed the finances of the country. So it was due to be looked at. Now, what these guys have done is they've categorized Nigerian power co consumers into five bands: A, B, C, D, E. Band A, they've decided are people who, or let me say consumers, who should get not less than 20 hours of power per day. And then for the other bands, they've graduated them. And so for the other bands, they've largely kept the price where it was. For the band A, they've increased the price from 66 naira per kilowatt hour to 255, so about a 235% increase. And that's, but in doing that, they have to, because basically what you're saying is, some people are going to be charged more for them to have access to more hours of power. Because basically what you're saying is that we don't have enough power to go around, so we can't guarantee everybody will get 24 hours, and certainly not at the current price. And so we will, those who we think can afford it, will push power to them, but charge them higher. And they ran some math to show how it will be actually cheaper for those people to get all their power from the grid rather than from alternative sources like, running generators and things like that. And for the others, they will scale back power. So I think different levels and so on and so forth. Now, the crux of the matter now is, how do you identify who's a band A, who's a band B? The idea is that they are feeders that already supply power to certain places. They're already earmarked. And what they've done is to look through those feeders, and they actually said they downgraded maybe about 180 or so, or something like that, I can't remember, to band B, to so that they can ring fence the band A and truly know which feeders are band A, so that, and then communicate that to everyone. So all the discos were required to post it on their website so that you go and check where your account falls into, and then you can tell whether you're a band A or band B and know what you're going to be charged. So that's basically the model that they've rolled out. And so some people now have seen the bill that they will, I mean, the cost that they will be bearing on power now go up significantly. Now, challenge I have with this is the idea that rather than solving the problems with power that we have, is the idea that some people should get, power more than 20 hours a day and some others should not. Knowing fully well that those who do not get up to 20 hours a day will still need to go for alternative sources. And you are saying to us that the power, even at 255 naira per kilowatt hour, is cheaper than you buying diesel or buying petrol or whatever. So why not offer that to everybody? And why not solve the problems that stop you from being able to charge the tariff? And even at that, if you're going, if having a cost reflective tariff is the issue, why not graduate it over time? Why this huge spike that means that you have to continue to subsidize some people, you will charge some people higher, and you will deny some people access to power? So it's just a very convoluted, funny way of trying to solve a problem, in my view. And that's why we see a lot of confusion, because people don't, everybody thinks that their power has jumped up by 300%. People don't know where they fall into, and over time, I think they'll begin to realize that. And now you also have to keep an eye on the discos to ensure they're not playing games, because who's to know if they're actually not charging band B people higher tariffs and things like that. So, we have a funny way of finding the most complex way to solve problems, and that's what we're seeing here. Don't even get me started on the message that Adilabu was passing across about people not switching off their freezers or ACs. It's crazy.
Well, no, thank you, Felix. I need to bring in. I'll go to Chris first. Then come to Lebanon. Chris, you've heard what Felix has said. The question I have for you is, do you think there's even the capacity to deliver the electricity? Because they are saying people in Band A will get 20 hours a day. Do you think they can even deliver those hours of electricity, Chris?
Well, I without giving too much away, I know, and I'm sure you will know from talking to people who work or know more about this space, that a lot of the distribution companies in Nigeria have themselves admitted that their business model is not viable. I don't think personally that they can meet that demand. And that's just not me saying that. I recall seeing something in I think it was the Africa Report, where I believe it must have been Plateau State, but I will need to check. Where the Joss distribution company or the group, the consortium of distribution companies, said they were ready to take a hit on their investment. If the government came and bought them out, they would leave, because the capacity to meet that demand just does not exist. And I think part of this goes back to the privatization. I think it was in 2010 or 2012. And a lot of the things we expected to see coming out of that didn't happen. Part of that was to do with the kind of actors that ended up getting hold of these distribution companies. Part of that has to do with the issues and the lack of investment we've had in generation. You know, we haven't attracted. I don't think the Nigerian government has been able to attract enough private investment into generation and transmission on the upstream. And then you then compound it by a legacy of corruption that just exists, that has existed in the state-owned monopoly before it went into these private hands that weren't really private. So unfortunately, I don't believe that that's the case. I think the number is 4,500 megawatts. That hasn't changed in about 14 years now. It stayed static since privatization. There's huge technical inefficiency in the grid. The transmission systems aren't viable themselves. So it's really sad to see, because as Phoenix describes it, for some people, this would represent 300% an increase in the middle of a cost of living crisis. I also agree that subsidies should be phased out, but you would always look at the example of a country like Egypt that phased this out over a period while doing the necessary reforms within the sector to attract the right level of investment, reforming the regulatory environment, you know, having the generation, transmission and distribution stand on their own two feet. And I think what kind of made me have a kind of cynical chuckle was the fact that the guy who was announcing this said it's 1.14 trillion naira in subsidies, but now it will be targeted at vulnerable customers. And that I put that in air quotes, because I don't know about you, if you think about 300% increase in anything that you're paying for as a utility, as an essential utility, that would automatically make you a vulnerable customer. It doesn't matter, you know, where you sit in the income scale. I don't think there are that many people within Nigeria who are paying for electricity who can shoulder a 300% increase without being vulnerable or cutting back in other places. And it doesn't mean these people stop spending on fueling diesel and petrol generators. It doesn't mean that they don't invest heavily at private expense on solar systems, private solar systems. So it's quite interesting to see how how the whole privatization has been handled, and the fact that 14 years on, or 12 to 14 years on, the conversations are still exactly the same. Like Phoenix as well, I'd rather not comment on the idea that people should be should be switching off their conditioning units in the middle of a heat wave either.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Ilemona, because I was reading during the PDP, when the PDP was in power, I was reading their power reform plans. And one of the things they highlighted was the fact that it was not enough to generate power. You had to have the capacity to distribute, I mean, to transmit. And they said at the time, transmission was the weak link, and we needed about $20 billion to be able to upgrade transmission to the points that we could meet the need of all Nigerians, i.e. the power that's being generated would be able to be transmitted adequately. And they outsourced transmission on a temporary basis to a company called Manitoba Power. But the plan was Manitoba would then prepare the transmission company for a sale to a competent transmission company that can provide the investment that was needed. But it doesn't appear that that was done. So in your view, Ilemona, are we solving the wrong problems? Because from where I'm sitting, what's the point of raising the price of the tariff if you still can't transmit? Or am I missing something, Ilemona?
You're very right. And I'll take off from where Chris just stopped. Well, you guys know me. I'll talk about everything, including things that they refuse or they're saying they don't want to talk about. But let me start by answering your question. That is exactly where the problem is. The nation's transmission grid cannot routinely collapses. I think we've had how many collapses this year? Quite a number. Last year, there were, maybe more than 20? So the nation's transmission grid simply is unwieldy and cannot, in its current state, transmit any more power. So first of all, your problem is in power transmission. We generate, I think our installed generating capacity as of today, at least to the best of my knowledge, hovers around somewhere around roughly 12,500 megawatts, which is, in the first place, ridiculous for a nation of 200 million people. But that is already more than twice, going on three times the amount that we currently can transmit. Now, routinely, we transmit around 3,800 to 4,500 megawatts of electricity, right? Less than 10,000 megawatts. In fact, I think there was a time we hit 10,000 megawatts and government practically did a party. In any case, if you got investors in generation or in distribution without resolving the fundamental conundrum, you really haven't solved any problem. You really haven't. Which is why in the PDP, our first proposition in the 2023 elections regarding power, and a fundamental part of the plan for the privatization of the power sector, was we will have to resolve this transmission problem. How do you resolve it? Our proposition was also simple is not the word that I'll use, but it was straightforward. Break this thing up into smaller grids. Break it up into regional grids, if you will. But the realization is that unless you have significant investment in transmission, you're not going to resolve Nigeria's power problems. So what these people have done, we're increasing the rates because we want to invite investment, it's trying to slap lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig. Nobody is going to invest in generating power that they cannot transmit. Nobody is going to invest in distributing power that was not generated. So straight away, it doesn't work. Now, if you take into consideration this is where the economics of it all come into play. Now, there's an offering that, if you're in band A, stay in band A. And the people who are saying, I don't want to be in band A. I want to go to a lower band. whether it's band B or band C, because in the first place, I will not get the power. So the revenue that you think that you're going to generate or that you're promising these investors is that they will make these investors, and investors must be in quotes, because remember, nobody, I don't believe that you see a significant uptick in investment. But in any case, the revenue that you're promising them is also going to go away, because people are saying, I'm sorry, I'd rather go and buy fuel. I cannot afford this thing that I cannot afford to be paying for something that I'm not going to get in the first place. Or not just something I'm not going to get, something that if I get, I will not be appropriately billed for. A significant part of the electricity subscriber base in the country is unmetered. So you're having, so there are more important problems to resolve before you even begin to speak about raising tariffs. Your transmission problem is significantly more important to resolve. Your distribution problem in terms of metering customers is significantly more important to resolve. If you resolve those two, then the investors about which you speak for your generation and your distribution see the incentive to put their hard-earned money there. Anything else is reveals a lack of understanding of what the problems and what the concerns are. Before the 2023 general elections, I was all over the place, including on this program, saying that the policy propositions of the candidate of the PDM, People's Democratic Party, Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, were in many respects the most in-depth. I'm using this as an example to say, did we miss the turn somewhere? Because at least we should have been speaking. And I saw his statement a few days ago, or yesterday, which said, no, you cannot. You've just removed the subsidy on fuel. You're removing the subsidy on electricity. And yet, you're not giving the people the ability to earn more so that they can at least afford this new high costs of living that you're forcing down their throat. It doesn't make sense.
Thank you, Ilemona. My final question on this topic is to Phoenix, because I think Phoenix can provide analysis to us on the behaviors of Nigerian politicians. So, Phoenix, I was watching that.
What gives me that ball? Or that insight?
I was watching the video, and the power minister did that very classic Nigerian elder thing where he first of all contorted his face, or as they say in Nigeria, he squeezed his face, then leant forward, then did a wagging of the finger, then squinted his eyes, and then said, let us tell ourselves the bitter truth. And the thing with you, as you know, Nigerian political elders, as they say, let us tell ourselves the bitter truth. Oftentimes, it's not the truth they're about to tell us. But then he then declared that people abroad don't turn their freezers on 24/7, that Nigerians have a penchant of leaving their freezers on and then going out when it doesn't happen abroad. So is this, I don't understand, Phoenix, do you leave your freezer on where you are, or do you turn it off as soon as you leave the house?
I follow the guidance of the Honorable Minister. I now switch off my freezer. since we have a minister for power who doesn't understand how a basic thermostat works. Because if he did, he would understand that leaving the freezer on does not in any case mean that you are perpetually consuming power. But you see, these are the kinds of clowns that you have in office who even in trying to pass a message, which may be, because yes, we do need tariffs to be higher. There's no doubt that, look, there's no doubt that the power value chain is not seeing enough liquidity or enough, there's not enough economic value. But it's this thing about the chicken and the egg, right? You're not enabling the value chain to attract investment. Because when in 2015 this APC clowns came to power, their first priority was to try to undo the privatization that had just started, because the privatizations happened in 2013. That was when they sold the, you know, the GJ government built the power plants and then sold them on to the folks. So you're basically talking about less than 2 years that that had happened before these clowns came in, and they wanted to undo it because, of course, I mean, it was supposed to be the next big thing and everybody wanted their hands in the pie. It had been done under the PDP, so they believed that, look, they had missed the boat. So Fashola, the first, you know, term, was busy jumping up and down looking for legal means to undo it. And rather than focusing on what's done is done, how do we play our own part in terms of make sure that, you know, the gas agreements that needed to be in place to make sure that these guys have gas, the MYTO that needed to be reviewed, and the transmission, which they did nothing on for 8 years. And we all knew that, yes, you have a bottleneck. While we have generating capacity of 13 gigawatts, your transmission system is just barely 5. And so you cannot wield the power. And you've wasted the time, almost a decade of the entire country, doing nothing about obvious problems. And of course, in time, with the devaluation of the Naira, with you know, with all those things will happen, of course your tariffs will become, you know, incapable of meeting costs. They're no longer cost, you know, reliant. But these are things that, again, it's almost like the conversations we have around minimum wage. You don't do anything about minimum wage for 5-6 years. Then you come and then you are crying that people are asking for you to double it. Of course, they will ask for you to double it because inflation in your country is in double digits. If you had been doing it on an annual basis or even every 2 years, you know, doing incremental reviews, it's easier to do it bite size than to do nothing and then expect that when it becomes a big issue, you're going to have to do a big catch up. It's the same thing. And so, you know, but they deflect. They blame the people rather than take ownership for their own failures as a party, as APC, and all of the things that they've done to bring us to this point. And now they're claiming that the issue of power is because our people, you know, want to use power. I mean, want to use their ACs the way they want or don't want to ration. It's just ridiculous. And it just shows the caliber and the quality of thinking, because you can still pass that message, but you pass it in a way that lets people know that, yes, it's about, you know, it's about cost. So if you feel like you can afford it, why not? Put on everything you have and you use more power, you pay more. But you can ration your power at the right tariff, but you get it when you need it. That's the fundamental thing that they keep missing. A lot of people don't mind having 12 hours of power a day, but there is a period of time that they need that power. It's not available. It is this unpredictability. It is this, you know, inability to manage it for themselves. That is the issue that people are trying to solve for. And, you know, their failures are, you know, just keep bringing to the fore, and then they bring all these stupid arguments and you have somebody come on national television and be talking about, you know, what people do abroad quite clearly with no idea of what he's talking about. And actually, he thought he was actually making sense. But those are the kind of people that we have in power. So anyways, it just tells me that we should not expect any improvement in power over the next 3 years. And again, Nigerians will be looking forward to 2027, to the elections, and maybe they'll bring in somebody that can actually, that actually knows what needs to be done and can get it done.
You know the point that you were making, yeah, about the casual, careless speak of the minister. You need to understand, and I need Nigerians to understand, that these statements, when they make them, right, they make these statements because of the exact, they are a window into the thinking around the exact type of government or the leadership system that the APC has foisted and insists on maintaining on the Nigerian people. These people have created a feudal system where there's no, you ought not to have any control. How dare you want to enjoy some of the simpler things of life, like stable power? How dare you think that you can put on your air conditioner in the middle of a heat wave when we, the government, haven't approved it? How dare you think that you should have cold water that you can drink, or a freezer that you can preserve your food items and drinks and all that? How dare you? It is the latest in a long line of how dare yous that the APC throws in the face of the Nigerian people on a daily basis. It started with Tolu Ogunlesi coming to tell us, oh, you people are distorting the value of the currency with your love for seedless grapes, when he came and said that rather as a mean statement on behalf of the Buhari administration. And it has gone on from there. Oh, you are experiencing currency distortions because your women like purchasing hair from Brazil and other parts of the Southwest. To, oh, how dare you people? You people don't buy Nigerian products. You this, that, and the other. They've gone, and it's a constant attempt by the government to show that the Nigerian people are responsible for governmental failures. It is a case study to my mind of an inability to take responsibility for the consequences of wicked, insensitive, incompetent government policies, the failures of which everybody can predict. So we tell you these things are going to fail. You insist and call us names like they did, and they will tell you you are a whaler, right? And then after that, they fail. And when you say, hold on, but this thing has failed, they say, no, you don't wish the country well. You are wishing your country will fail. It is the mind games. And then the thing about it that really annoys me is that whenever they bring these policies up and people speak up, they have a band of useful idiots, people I like to call slow boiling frogs, who will come out and defend on behalf of the government the very policies that are set and designed to kill them in the first place. And it makes me wonder, are we not? I heard Buba Galadima's statement yesterday, where somebody said to him in an interview that Nigerians are suffering, and his response was, "And let them die. Should be next time if the government has peppered them enough, we will see whether they will collect money from politicians to vote, or they will vote the right thing." And to be honest, as much as a part of me screams, a significant part of me screams and fights against that conclusion, because at the end of the day, this country is our country, belongs to all of us, and these sufferings, we are the ones that are suffering it one way or the other. There's a part of me that understands what that man was talking about.
Thank you, Ilemona, Chris, and Phoenix.
Sorry, Michael. Just before you close that off, I just want to, in the spirit of Ilemona's masterful contribution, just to say thank you so much to the APC, very popular APC lawmaker, who I think in the last week or so was distributing electricity generating machines, so electricity generators, to his constituents as part of his constituency work. So that just kind of lays it all bare. That a member of the ruling party within the legislature sees it fit to distribute kind of handheld electricity generating machines to people. It just lays bare the fact that we sadly are not blessed with really competent people in the three arms of government.
No, thank you, Chris. Well, because of time, we have to move on to our final topic. Hopefully, we turn off our freezers after this conversation so that we don't offend our power minister. Now, there's drama in Kaduna, Phoenix. The current governor, Uba Sani, claims that he's unable to perform because he inherited significant debt from his predecessor. He says $587 million, 85 billion naira, and 115 contractual liabilities. He then further says that of the 10 billion that was allocated to his company in the month, to his state in the month of March, 7 billion of that was used to service debt. So he's only left with 3 billion to pay salaries. And although the state's salary bill is actually 5.2 billion, so it means he's owing salaries for March. Now, Phoenix, do you or should we feel, or should Nigerians feel sorry for Governor Uba Sani, who has now told us that he can't deliver because he inherited significant debt from his predecessor? Phoenix, well, what is your take?
There's no reason why anyone should feel sorry for him. I never feel sorry for any politician who buys a form to contest, because I would expect that you've done your due diligence. You know what you're going there to do. You know what you're going to take over. And so you should not come and be telling us stories. You went in with your eyes wide open. And it's not even going to be someone like Uba Sani, who was also, you know, a party to some of, you know, the goings on in Kaduna State, and supported some of these things in the past. So for me, there's no pity for anyone. And especially because we also know that all these governors, we should be holding their feet to the fire, especially given the fact that their coffers have been significantly swelled by the devaluation of the naira, and how that has helped FARC increase significantly. So they are flush with naira, you know, and so nobody should be allowed to make excuses and that's why for me, when the moment he then said, "Oh, but by the way, we've not borrowed money," I said, "Yeah, I don't expect you to borrow money when the fact that you're getting is more than times three what people before you used to get before." But I think that's on the one side. The fact still remains that yes, I mean, he's not lying that he did inherit, you know, significant debts, which his predecessor, El-Rufai, did mention before he left, and then what he was handing over to him. The question with debt for me is always, what did you use it for? And what value have you created? And how is that going to help the people, you know, beyond, you know, the time that you've been there? Because a big part, in as much as there has been the blessing of, let's call it blessing in quotes, of the valuation of naira giving you more naira earnings, there's also the fact that if you have FX loans and you have to generate naira to pay your FX loans, you also have to generate more naira now to pay, which perhaps explains why out of 10 billion, 7 billion is being withheld, you know, to meet obligations at source before the money even comes to him. And so you go back and say, for example, one big ticket loan was a $350 million loan from the World Bank. And you ask, what was the value created by this loan? What was it? You know, that's the kind of questions that we should be asking, you know, because if there was value created, then of course, in time, that value will begin to show up. But when you dig into that loan and begin to look at the kinds of things that the money was used for, it really blows my mind. That money was split into 10 parts of $35 million each. Some of the things that I've seen shared, you know, he spent $35 million on the development of legal and institutional framework for PPP. $35 million on increasing IGR outrun. So for me, that's where the real conversation needs to be. It is not that money was borrowed. It is not, you know, because if you can borrow money and show that you can pay it back, and you show that you're going to use it to create value, which would have the multiplier effect to increase your economy, increase your revenue, increase and provide the infrastructure and the things that will enable private enterprise to thrive, then of course, go for it. But from what we see, there are question marks as to where, how that money was used, which has now become a burden on the government.
Thank you, Phoenix. Ilemona, coming to you, the argument a number of people have made is, first of all, Nasir Arafai was in the APC and Uba Sani was his chosen successor. So it's not even a case of PDP taking over from APC. You were in the same party. You were close allies. And the claim is that even for these external loans to have been approved, the Senate, the federal Senate, had to approve. And Uba Sani was one of the senators that voted in favor of El-Rufai taking these loans. So the question Nigerians are asking is, well, you voted for him to take these loans. At the time, Shehu Sani, who was El-Rufai's rival, opposed it. And I remember Shehu Sani being insulted by El-Rufai and many people for opposing the loans. But Uba Sani voted for the loans. He was a close ally of El-Rufai. He's coming to power now, and he's telling us these stories. So, and I think your party has responded. But what is your view? Does this make sense, Ilemona?
It does. Like everything that concerns the APC doesn't make sense. There's nothing about the APC that makes sense. And the APC is constantly banking on the fact that Nigerians, maybe some Nigerians, won't understand issues as well or as in-depth so that they can get away with it, right? Like you've rightly said, Uba Sani was the one senator from the APC who voted in support of these loans. Eventually, prior to that, you had there were senators from the PDP who had opposed the loans between 2015 and 2019. Three, there were senators Shehu Sani, Danjuma La'a, and then there was a third senator who had said these loans. Not only are these loans excessive, they also, there's no explanation about the way the expenditure will be now. They took that from the principles that had been implemented by my former boss and mentor, Dr. Bukola Saraki, while he was at the Senate. Every time that the Buhari administration came and said, approve a loan, they always asked, show us the numbers, show us how the loans will be repaid, show us the value add, show us, what we'll be getting for our money. And they didn't always get that, which was the reason why, one of the reasons why the Buhari administration hated Dr. Saraki's guts, which is also one of the reasons why the, as a person, Nasir El-Rufai really hated the guts of those other senators who voted to reject his loans. But the thing is, the only reason why you're hearing about this is because there's conflict in the political camps between Nasir El-Rufai and his chosen godson, the governor of Kaduna State. His name escapes me just now. Yes, Senator Uba Sani. There's only one reason. It's because of the politics. It's not because of they would have carried on business as usual. It is because politically, both men have fallen out. And now that they've fallen out, they're using all the wrongdoings that they had done together in secret, away from the Nigerian people. They're using it to fight each other and hoping that the Nigerian people will fall on one side of the fence or the other. My advice to the people in Kaduna, and then to the Nigerians, who bin the both of them, throw the two of them in the trash can. They are cahoots. They are partners. They are allies in causing that problem that now plagues the Kaduna people. The Kaduna people are going to be paying $350 million worth of loans because those two men conspired together and foisted that debt obligation, that gives no value to the Kaduna people, on them, on the Kaduna people. They are both culpable. They are both responsible. And one person pointing fingers and shouting, yeah, it's you that caused it, when they both organized, implemented, executed, and then shared. It's not something that anybody should accept.
Thank you, Lemona. Now, let me come to you, Chris. Chris, the drama then turned into a family heat argument with El-Rufai's son heading to social media to attack the governor. He said the governor is deflecting from his responsibilities, that the governor is incompetent, that is a governor who is always sleeping in Abuja with incompetent and has incompetent aides. And rather than take responsibility, he's now trying to pass the buck. And the son is Bashir El-Rufai. So a number of people have said, why is El-Rufai's son engaging in such behavior? But what are your thoughts, Chris? Is it a free-for-all? Is El-Rufai's son allowed to insult the governor like this?
Well, apparently so. I don't think anyone is above being insulted by the gentleman in defense of his father. He might well be right that that the current governor is incompetent. As both Lemona and Phoenix have said, he was a key part of this debt balloon that's exploding. So he's just engaging in a little bit of backside covering at the moment, which I don't think many people will believe. But rather than hearing from the former governor's son, it'd be interesting to hear from the former governor himself. I haven't seen anywhere where he's actually accounted for his stewardship of the state's Commonwealth over his 8 years. I recall when he did the handover, he made a speech in a kind of throwaway remark within the larger speech where he said, well, I'm really sorry for you, or something along those lines. You have a big task ahead of you. I've left you debt of $500 million. And it felt like a tenant passing on to someone to say, oh, actually, there's a light bulb broken in the upstairs bathroom. Hope you can deal with it. This is much bigger than that. It's not meant to be a throwaway remark or the fact that his son is slinging mud at his father's predecessor. It'd be really good for him to come out and talk about his stewardship and what all of this was spent on. Phoenix called out two line items. Like I always do, I like looking at these line items. There was $26 million in there for streetlights and a primary health care center. I mean, there was $51 million for a 300-bed hospital, which never saw completion. So there's real questions to be asked and answered. This is dollars. This is foreign exchange. This is money that could have been used to invest in generating real value that would better the lives of people. There was 3.5 billion naira for security gadgets, unspecified security gadgets. So unfortunately, this looks like a lot of things you see coming out of the Nigerian state and the Nigerian budgetary processes in the last 8 years, of really, really brazen expenditure and grabbing. You know, I can't say for a fact where all of these things have gone. Must have gone into private pockets, no doubt. But the former governor himself really needs to come out and give account of his stewardship of the state's Commonwealth. His son making public statements is a real distraction. There are real questions for the former governor to answer, and it'd be better off that he answers them rather than his son playing the role of an attack dog.
Thank you, Chris. Let me just
I will quickly try, like, to throw back to our earlier conversation when we were speaking about Biden. Yeah. Now, off the back of this particular point that we have just, you know, discussed, and the opacity and the ridiculousness of the spending of dollar-denominated loans, right? Remember that the accusation was, at the time, or one of the accusations from the government has been Nigerians like to use dollars, or we buy dollars to fund our sleepwalkers lifestyle, thereby distorting the economy, and then, you know, the value of the currency and what have you. But here are governments, here is a state government, one of many, that simply cannot account properly, adequately, for $500 million. For $500 million. So is it really us that we're doing the distortions? Are Nigerians, the people, the ordinary Nigerians in the street, you and me who try to pay school fees? We heard the CBN governor speaking about, oh, there's so much pressure on the Naira because students want to pay foreign school fees in dollars and pounds and what have you. But here are whole state governments. This is one state. This is one particular set of loans. This has nothing to do with, you know, their FACO locations or their other pilferings and all of that. This is one state that cannot adequately show proper expenditure for $500 million. And the government has the guts to blame me, that is just trying to earn a better life for myself and my family, for the distortions of the value of the Naira and the economic problems that we face. These people need to get out of here. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Lebanon and Chris. I just want to ask Phoenix a final question. So, Phoenix, I've seen some commentary alluding to the fact that these attacks on El Rufai are politically motivated, that apparently the Bola Tinubu administration is trying to cut him down to size because he might be a potential threat to Tinubu's aspirations in 2027. So these stories are part of an offensive aimed at clipping El Rufai's wings. Do you think there's merit to these allegations, Phoenix?
Well, I can't speak to what politicians, you know, do or their proxies do on their behalf. I mean, there may be something to it. In my view, I don't see any electoral value at the national level for El Rufai that should create any loss of sleep for Tinubu, who now has the state apparatus. He's the president. It's not like El Rufai is a popular guy. I don't see him being on a ballot that would threat anybody who tries to get on a ballot with El Rufai is basically just, you know, looking to carry a poison chalice. So, but at the end of the day, it's not as if our political class is peopled with people who Chris will appreciate this, being the strategy guy, who are strategic. So, people, you have a lot of blunt instruments who will just go and do this kind of thing or create noise just because in their own simple minds, they think that it's helping their boss. But if you really look at it, I don't see why anybody would be worried about him at this point in time. I just don't see how he adds anything. But you can never rule out proxies being proxies in this Nigeria.
Thank you. I have a habit of jumping in comments. Yeah. So I'll just chip in here as well.
Yes,
please. In 2014, there's an old clip from 2014 where El Rufai himself was responding that, and his statement was, and they say that we are politicizing everything. Yes, that's the work of the opposition. It's our work to politicize everything. And if you're not doing it very well, we'll say you're not doing it well so that we'll tell people not to vote for you. If you say if you don't want us to politicize it, then fix the problem. And so I'm here to say the same thing. You created a problem. You don't want me to politicize it. Why did you create the problem? So even if they say we agree, the only reason why we're able to politicize it is because you created a problem. The only reason why we will politicize anything that concerns Nasiru El-Rufai is that he creates a series of problems that negatively impact the lives, well-being, and welfare of the Nigerian people. So if they are saying that, oh, we politicized it and they're expecting us to back down, of course not. You gave us a problem. It's politics. Politics is exactly that. Politicizing the missteps, deliberate or mistaken, of your opponents. And that's all we're doing. We're doing it deliberately. We're not even with our full chest. We politicized it. We are politicizing it. We will politicize it. If you don't want us to politicize it, then don't do it. If you do it, we'll politicize it. It's very simple.
Thank you, Ilemona, for what has been an interesting conversation. But our time is up, so I must first of all thank our listeners for being loyal and listening to us. And we apologize, we weren't here last week. Last week was Easter. So those of us who are Christians, we're celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. But we're back this week, and hopefully we'll see you again next week. And until then, I say have a fantastic 7 days to everyone.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Limona and Chris, for joining us. And thank you, listeners. Have a great week, everyone.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thank you. Thank you, Michael and Phoenix, for having us. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having us.